You are Locked On Pacers, your daily Indiana Pacers podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Pacers fans, welcome into this Tuesday edition of the Locked On Pacers podcast. Got a lot to get to today. We'll recap the Hornets game that happened last night. Tomorrow, it'll be me and Adam for that one. But for this one, we have a very special guest and someone who got me into the sport, so it's very cool for me. Nate Duncan from the Twitter NBA show and his own Dunked On basketball podcast. Nate, how are you, man?
I'm doing really well. Looking forward to talking some Pacers here.
Yeah, one of the more surprising teams around the league. They've been generating a lot of buzz recently with their good play. I pinned them for 28 wins on the year in the preseason. They're already at 27, so I look really stupid. You cover the league more nationally than I do. I'm more in tune with the local team. But for you, you know, I know before the season when you did your Pacers preseason predictions, you had them as a, you know, you thought they'd be a worse offense than they've turned out to be so far. What has been the most surprising thing about this team for you so far? Has it been that offense, or has it been that they've been kind of competent on defense? You know, what has it been for you?
No, I think it's been the offense for sure, and obviously the play of Victor Oladipo. I'm not sure what your take was, but obviously Danny and I panned their deal for Paul George to just get Sabonis and Oladipo. Didn't think Oladipo was going to be a great contract. Didn't like the fact that there wasn't really anything that appeared to be a path to star-level talent in what they got back. And, of course, that has proved so far with Oladipo's performance this year to have been completely wrong. And that's been the biggest thing for me is Oladipo's ability, the additional explosion that he's shown off the dribble, I think in part from getting into better shape, but also perhaps even more than that, his ability to hit the pull-up three-pointer. And that's been something that really just opens up so much of the offense. I mean, obviously he's not on the level of Steph Curry, but you see that where just, you know, they don't have to blitz him on pick and rolls, but you have to go over every time. And that lets him get downhill and get to the lane. And then he's been able to set up some of these other players. We thought that, you know, this was a team that at least had some guys who could hit the three, but you didn't see who was going to be the one who would draw the defense and set them up. And Oladipo has provided that.
Yeah, and I know you and Danny have talked about with Ben Simmons sometimes, how when defenders lay off of him, he's able to just get enough speed to get by him anyway when he has the space. And Oladipo has the advantage even more of because the pull-up three has been falling at over 40% rate. You know, they have to get out on him even farther. And he's so much faster than whoever's guarding him, unless it's a Russell Westbrook or a John Wall, that he just cooks everyone on his way to the rim. And it's been setting up easy looks for, you know, literally everyone. And outside of Bogdanovich, most guys are having career years from deep.
Yeah. And there are a lot of guys who are underrated shooters on this team. Darren Collison being one of those. You know, he toiled in Sacramento the last 3 years. And so people kind of lost the fact that he'd matured into being a high 30s, low 40s three-point shooter, and they've gotten a little bit above expectation shooting from guys like Corey Joseph. And then I think the other thing that's been impressive was that we thought their backup bigs were going to just be really bad. It was Young and Turner seemed like a decent enough starting front court, but then Sabonis was well below replacement level last year. And then now the fact that he's actually been able to play at center a lot of time, especially at the very beginning of the year, it was such a revelation. And his passing, the chemistry that he's had on DHOs, they do a lot of plays where instead of traditional pick and rolls, they'll throw it to Sabonis and then just do a quick dribble pitch back to the ball handler. And he's really helped improve the pace of their offense as well, just even in the half court with moving the ball, quick decision making. And so that might have been the other thing that we didn't anticipate, but maybe also even just to say, hey, when you put this many quality shooters on a team, that you're probably going to be better than we would have thought anyway. I think maybe that's was another miscalculation as well.
Yeah, I wrote about Sabonis's decision making last week, and because they really do space the floor around him, that's one of McMillan's strengths, is catering the offense to the lineup that's on the court. And because he's been, you know, that quick decision maker, he always passes it out to the corner when he needs to. He stops short on his rolls when he catches the ball, if that's what's asked of him. You know, his assist percentage is like top 10 for a center for centers this year. And, you know, who would have thought of that last year after an OKC, all he did was take long twos and miss right-handed layups. So it's been a revelation to see him get that added pass.
Oh, no, that's not fair. He never even took right-handed layup.
I remember he took one right-handed layup this year, and literally everyone I follow on Twitter tweeted Sabonis right hand exclamation point. Yeah. It was really exciting. You're right. He doesn't ever shoot with that right hand. That would make him a starting level player. I don't know if you, how many Pacers people you follow, but there have been some rumblings that people want him to start over Miles Turner going forward, which is ludicrous.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, I don't think it's ridiculous to say that he might be better for them right now, as offensively, just because of the additional decision making that he provides as a team that doesn't have a ton of passing. Oladipo is a solid passer. Collison's probably below average for a point guard. So I definitely think the offense runs more smoothly when he's out there as opposed to with Turner, but certainly for the long-term health of the franchise. I mean, this team is not going to go anywhere to get back to being a contender in the East unless Miles Turner can become the type of two-way beast that people believe that he has the potential for.
Yeah, we're hopeful. You know, the defense looks like it's almost there. So if he can take some guys off the dribble or get a little bit of banging in the post, he'll be quite the two-way threat. But let's go back to the two guys we've already talked about a little bit. You know, I know when you the Pacers played the Magic on Saturday, but when they played earlier in the year, you called it the regression bowl, which I thought was hilarious. But Sabonis and Oladipo have kept up their really good play from the start of the year and held it going for, going on 50 games now. Do you think they can keep up what they've kind of shown for 50 games now, or do you think they're going to come back a little bit? And as they transition into the next era of Pacers basketball post-Paul George, you know, do you think those two guys will be as good as they are now, a little better? You know, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that for Sabonis, it really makes more sense that he could keep this up. He's younger than Oladipo. He also is a guy who is shooting pretty well on long twos, but that's not where he's not dependent on that for his value. And I think that's something that he can be good at. He hasn't been shooting the three much this year. And, you know, I think he can get better around the rim, but despite his limitations with the right hand, he's still been a quality finisher. He can squirt inside. He's got great hands to finish around the rim, and he makes good decisions in pick and roll. So those are all things that I don't expect to go away. And, you know, I think he can make some incremental improvements with his athletic limitations. I'm not sure how far he can get. And, you know, especially defensively, is he really going to be a rim protector? Maybe his upside is more kind of someone like Cody Zeller defensively, as someone who can move his feet and get in his chest in front of guys. But with his short wingspan, he's never going to be a great shot blocker. But I think Sabonis can continue to take strides because, you know, the number one thing you look at on whether a guy is going to regress is there unsustainable jump shooting. And for Oladipo, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if he settles in as more of, you know, a 36 to 38% three-point shooter for the rest of his career. And right now, actually, on above the break threes, he's only at 37%. He's shooting lights out from the corners, well over 50%, I think, on, you know, maybe like 25 attempts or something like that. So, and that's what gets his percentage up close to 40. So when you look at his ability to hit the off the dribble three, and we know that it really takes 750 attempts before you can feel confident in a player's 3-point shooting performance being indicative of their future performance. So certainly given where he was at previously in his career, you would expect some modicum of regression there, but he's played at easily an all-star level so far this year. So even if he drops off there, I think he can be a very good player, you know, maybe not an all-star every year, but a guy who's in the conversation every year. You know, that's probably what I would end up expecting from him in the long term here.
Yeah, and that's kind of, you know, that's exactly what they would hope for. Both of those answers, if you ask them before this trade, you know, what they're getting back is like, okay, we're getting a future starting post player and a borderline all-star every year. So good on the front office, and proof that we all can't play Twitter GM, right? Because we all thought that, including myself, that the trade was awful. So pretty hilarious there. But pivoting to two other guys on the team who weren't part of the trade, Miles Turner and Glenn Robinson III are two fan favorites due to both their age and skills for their age. Glenn Robinson has not played yet this year, though, so a little tougher to gauge where he's at. But what are your thoughts on those two guys? You know, Turner was one of them, you know, everyone would say, oh, he's the least talked about unicorn ever. But, you know, this year he's kind of been underwhelming and Robinson hasn't played at all. So what do you think of those two guys?
Well, GR3 is a subset of the type of player that is the hardest to evaluate for me, and I think for a lot of teams in the NBA as well, because the 3-and-D wing, number one, defense is very difficult to evaluate, and guys especially who are young, you don't know whether they're going to get it, even if they do have the physical tools. I mean, if you looked at like Gerald Green coming out of high school, like, man, this guy's a crazy athletic. Like, he could probably become a great defender. And obviously, you know, he's way too spacey for that. That never happened. That's an extreme example. And then the three part of it too, for the reasons we just talked about, with where it takes so many attempts really to see whether a guy can be a good 3-point shooter. And, you know, I think GR3 at one point, like, I think it was last year, was shooting like 40%, but it was, you know, 20 out of 50 or something like that, you know, so that's nearly meaningless. So really for him, you know, it could go either way, right? And obviously this severe ankle injury that's had him out for the whole season, that is going to set back his development. And they're also, of course, going to have to re-sign him at some point too, if they want to keep him around. So it's really difficult to say. He's a guy who has a lot of athletic potential. We'll see whether he looks as athletic once he comes back from this injury. And then, you know, is he going to be able to hit the three, especially outside of the corners as well? We really just don't know the answer to that at this point. And I really, it's very difficult to determine that. I mean, you can go watch a guy in warmups and kind of see how he's looking there and just see whether, you know, how confident he looks shooting the ball and what the versatility of his shot is. But really, you know, I don't think anyone has the answer to, all right, is this guy's 3-pointer going to go in? And when your value is nearly entirely dependent on, you know, he can run the floor and he's athletic there, but, you know, that's mostly kind of dependent and not something that's huge. So a huge part of his game, getting to the basket. So, you know, the question of whether his 3-ball is going to go in, I don't really know the answer to that. And whether he's going to get it defensively, I don't really know the answer to that either. That's why you get a bunch of those guys who are athletic and have that potential and hope that you hit on some of them.
Yeah. And you've hit my, pretty much all my fears to a T there. You know, he shot 39% from three last year and 38% the year before, but combined, it was only like 160 attempts. So, you know, you don't know how much you can read into something like that. And a lot of his defense, you know, is like you said, is that he's an athleticer guy and he has no trouble staying in front of other wings, even ones that are quicker than him. But with a severe ankle sprain, you wonder how much of that will even dissipate. And I've always been fearful this year that when he returns, you know, I think the defense will take a step forward to be certain. They'll be better at defending at the point of attack and on the catch. But the offense might take a step back, especially on the second unit, because his value was tied to 3-point shooting and cutting. And if the shot's not falling and he's less athletic, so the cutting will be worse, you know, maybe the step back on offense is bigger than the step forward on defense. And it's impossible to say until we see him.
Yeah, and of course, he's going to be an unrestricted free agent this offseason as well. And he'll have a small cap hold and they'll have bird rights on him. They can pay him more once they use their cap space this offseason. But, you know, obviously, when you're unrestricted, you have the ability to go wherever you want. So even if he does play well, there's a chance that he could end up leaving. And then getting to your question about Turner, you know, offensively, I think that my expectations for him might have been a little lower than a lot of people. And he's got the ability to put the ball on the floor every now and then, but not something that I really saw a lot of from him. And he's not really a power player in the post. We've seen it on very rare occasions for him, but especially against switches, his go-to move, it seems like, is, all right, I'll catch the ball at 15 feet and then just turn over my right shoulder and just shoot over you, you know, which could be effective, especially if it's late in the clock. But, you know, I don't think anybody's quaking in their boots about switching a pick and roll or a pick and pop with him when that's his go-to move. You know, if you have to do that, you have to do that. And that's a shot that he might make even at, you know, at a 40% rate or so. It's still contested, even though he's taller. So he's got to get the ability really to beat switches. And then obviously the shot's got to go down from three. I mean, I think he can get there, but can he be like a true pick and pop 3-point shooter? Is he more of just a spot up guy offensively? You know, I don't know that he is going to get to the point of being, you know, a guy you would think of as a classic second option offensively. I'm not sure quite how he can scale up to that level of usage unless he can really get a lot better in the post, which, or on pick and pops. Like, those seem like the ways that it's going to have to happen. And then on defense, he's one of the best shot blockers. If you're just like, hey, I want someone to go block a shot, this guy is going to the basket, I don't want you to make a miss, I want you to block his shot. Turner and maybe Hassan Whiteside are the two best guys in the league with that. But Turner, you don't see a ton of the verticality plays from him. You don't see a ton of the recognition. And then certainly when he gets out on the floor in pick and roll defense, he's looked like a liability. So I think you really, in looking at the numbers, other than blocked shots, you would be hard pressed to construct an argument right now that he is anything more than an average defender. And there are a lot of indicators that indicate that he's below average. And so certainly a guy with his length, his short area quickness around the rim, his timing, blocking shots, there's always the potential that he could become an elite defender, but he's got a long way to go.
I agree with all of that. And, you know, they have a good problem in that they have two young big men who are both talented, and a lot of people have clamored for them to play together. And that was talked about a lot at practice last week, but, you know, neither of them, Sabonis or Turner, can defend outside of 10 feet at all. And, you know, on offense, it would probably work. You know, Turner can be a four, I guess, in the Ryan Anderson mold. It'd be kind of weird. But, and then Sabonis at the five. But on defense, it'd be horrible because neither of them can guard either position particularly well. Nonetheless, a four who stretches away from the basket. So you almost need that Thaddeus Young kind of guy alongside of him on defense to give him some hope that he can just stand under the basket and help out. And, you know, like you said, on offense with the three-pointer, his three-point percentage dropping this year has been a really big problem. And I know he's been injured, so maybe there's less to that, but who really knows? It's got to fall for him to be that elite pick and pop threat that they hoped he could be. And that fadeaway over shorter guys, you know, that's great that he's trying to shoot like Dirk with his leg kick and everything like that, but it's not going in that much this year. It looks awesome when it does, but it's just not going in that much. So, you know, he needs more of that conventional post style of offense to be that effective on switches that he shows. He, like you said, he has that power occasionally, but until he shows it, you know, he's just kind of stagnated from year to year so far. And that's kind of why it's been disappointing to me, is because he's 21 and he's stagnated.
Yeah, the only thing I would add, too, is that he really has not been any kind of a force on the glass. His defensive rebound rate is okay for a center, is about 20%. But if you just – and obviously there are other limitations in rebounding with the rest of the team as well. This isn't all his fault. But he's not a great box-out guy. He can get kind of thrown around. He's got a high center of gravity, so he can't really carve out space on the defensive glass. He's not an elite athlete to just go and get the ball either. And then on the offensive end, he spends a lot of time away from the basket, but, you know, 4.7% offensive rebounds is pretty weak for a center as well. So one of their Achilles heels on defense especially has been this year, and he has not been a part of the solution with
Yeah, you know, Thaddeus Young stretches the floor, and he has a 2% higher offensive rebound rate. So I totally agree with you there that even if you're going to stretch out the floor, you have to be higher than 4.7%, especially as a center. And I think his defensive rebounding rate could be higher, you know, if he was a little bit better of an actual rim protector. But he goes for those blocks so much that he ends up landing at a position where he doesn't get it, and then he just doesn't get the rebound.
Yeah, no, that's – so he's – I mean, you really – the idea with him is that you don't want to have to play with another traditional big next to him. And if he can't really anchor the defensive glass on his own, which is, you know, that's a tough task, but you'd hope that a guy with his size could do that eventually. So he's got a lot of potential with the shooting potential and the ability to block shots, but a lot of facets to his game that really need to be well-rounded. And his contract extension talks this offseason are going to be very interesting. I think he could be a candidate to really get overpaid in an extension by a Pacers team that has usually not been too excited about letting guys get to restricted free agency. And, you know, they've been hurt by Paul George leaving. You could see them very easily kind of caving in the negotiations, wanting to keep this team together after the feel good story this year. And I'm not sure that Turner has shown, I mean, he certainly has the potential to get there, but I don't know that he's shown the ability to be a $20 million a year player, because if you look at where he ranks among the league centers right now, he's probably around average, if even there.
Yeah, and paying guys for potential is a very, very slippery slope, especially when they stagnate from year 2 to 3. And you kind of stole our thunder, because our Wednesday show is our trade deadline primer, and I was going to bring up something like that, but yeah, the extension talks will be fascinating. You know, before the year, I would have said $20 million for sure, but now I'm definitely pumping the brakes on that per year. But that is a great transition into our next topic, which is the trade deadline is near. It's only 11 days away, 10 days away. And, you know, the Pacers are an overachieving team, and you got to hope that, you know, they can kind of realize that they're overachieving and not do anything crazy. But with, you know, $5.8 million in space, a little over that, you know, an empty roster spot, some you know, some good contracts that are expiring, which like you and Danny talked about on some of your trade preview episodes, you know, there's not a lot of expiring contracts around the league this year. You know, what moves do you think they can try to make around the deadline, if anything?
Well, I think there's a couple of capacities they could go in, a couple of directions they could go in. One would be just kind of treating it more like, hey, you know what? We're really happy with how this has gone this year. We've got some guys who are good players. We can potentially hold on to them for next year with their non-guarantees, or see what our cap space could do for us. They also don't know whether Thad Young is going to opt out or not. And so they say, hey, you know, we're going to make the playoffs this year. I think they probably will, especially with the Pistons struggles lately, as long as Oladipo can stay healthy. And so they say, hey, this is great. What we're doing on the floor this year is gravy. Why don't we just, we'll use that space to pick up maybe a Kyle Singler from OKC who would fit into their remaining cap space, try to pick up another couple of assets, you know, maybe a Noah Vonleh from Portland. Those are two teams that are really trying to avoid the luxury tax. Vonleh is actually someone who might help them, frankly, the rest of the year.
Indiana graduate Noah Vonleh.
Yeah, no, I mean, apparently there's something in the water where Indiana graduates who have underperformed immediately come to the Pacers and start to be awesome. But no, I mean, as a fourth big, Vonleh actually could help them, because they're really, I think, struggling there when they go to Al Jefferson or TJ Leaf, and especially if there are any injury concerns among their top three bigs. So that might be a move that they could look at, where, and maybe even Vonleh would be someone they could look to re-sign potentially in the offseason, depending on what his salary demands are. So that's one way that they could go, is just taking out bad money, trying to get some more assets for the future. I mean, this core is very young right now. I think they should be aiming for 2-3 years from now, as when these guys are going to hit their peak, and try to get some more assets for the future. Or they could go another direction as well, where, another thing they could do too would be, if they wanted to move Al Jefferson, they could take back a really bad contract from another team. Now, I think we all know what this team really needs in the future to compete is, they need a guy who can defend on the wing, and maybe GR3 can be that guy, but you don't want to count on that. But I'm not sure that kind of player, especially one with the youth who could peak at the same time as the rest of this team, is available on the trade market at this point in time. And so I think they need to continue to draft, continue to try to develop a player like that, because trading for, you know, a 3-and-D type of player seems unlikely. Maybe one guy that they could try to look at is, if Jay Crowder has really fallen out of favor in Cleveland, that maybe they could try to pick him up, also take on some bad money from the Cavs at the same time, and then maybe, you know, hope he's still got 2 years left on his contract after this one, hope that he can rebound after, you know, he's had a really bad year this year. That might be the type of move they might want to make. And then, you know, they could maybe take on Channing Frye as well this year to reduce the Cavs luxury tax bill, and they probably would have to give up something in terms of assets there as well, but that could be someone that they could target. But I mean, that's the number one need, is be on the lookout for someone who can play a 3-and-D role at the three, guard the other team's best players. And then if that's not available, I think just take on some bad money and try to get some assets for the future.
That is pretty much exactly what I hope they do. My dream trade is they somehow do Jefferson for Mahinmi and Kelly Oubre, but I don't think the Wizards would ever trade Kelly Oubre, because they have absolutely no young players at all. And then another one that's actually extremely relevant given some news today is, I think Avery Bradley would fit really nicely in a lineup with Oladipo as a guy who can, you know, he is, his problem on the Pistons this year, beyond being a pretty overrated off-ball defender, is that he's their second option on offense, and he's not a good second option on offense. But I think on Indiana, he'd be third or fourth.
And yeah, well, he thinks he's the second option on whatever offense that he's on.
That is true.
Which is part of the problem there.
It is. And I don't know how you would tame that for him here, but, you know, I think if he's the guy locking down the other team's best wing, and you give Oladipo a little more offensive energy with that, or, you know, everyone's going to be better on defense than Bogdanovich has been this year. So, you know, I would like the idea of an Avery Bradley kind of trade, but I don't know what, you know, the money sending out would be, or what the Pistons are looking for, considering their 8-game losing streak. So it is tough to see right now, but I think they ultimately will just end up standing pat.
Yeah, that seems the most likely, other than just maybe taking on a little bad money for one of these tax teams, because the fit there is so good. Bradley, I think for a number of reasons, I would, unless the price were just incredibly low, which I don't think it's going to be. I mean, I think there's enough respect for Bradley around the league, and he makes a low enough salary that, you know, probably a first round pick would be required. That's too much for the Pacers to give up for Bradley, considering number one, he could be an unrestricted free agent. And number two, he's really a three. And if you're asking him to guard the other team's three or Oladipo, I mean, you would be taking Bogdanovich out of the rotation, asking Oladipo to play the three. That's really probably beyond him from a size perspective. And then, you know, Bradley can't really guard the other team's three either. You'd be taking Collison off the floor, who's been great for the Pacers this year. So he wouldn't be the guy that I would necessarily look for there. I mean, I think actually someone that they might want to look at is James Ennis. I think he could be useful from, he's coming back from a calf injury now, but he's someone who I think could give them, if not great shooting on the wing, at least enough of a threat and a credible option to guard the other team's best wing threats, which they really just don't have on this team right now. And thus GR3 can come back and provide that. And then they would still have early bird rights on him. He would still have a pretty small cap hold this offseason to be about $4 million. So that wouldn't really, they could bring him back if they wanted to, and they would still be able to use their cap space this offseason. So he would be someone that I would target for them as well. He's going to be 28 this offseason, so not too old. And it's really, I think they need a three much more than a two.
Yeah, and he's a four-year veteran, 28-year-old. So he's a young 28, if that's the thing. But I only know that because on an earlier podcast of the show, I talked to my co-host Adam Friedman, and I said they should get James Ennis because of the exact same reasons you mentioned. You know, he's a good three. The early bird's totally going to be enough for him because it's, 120% of league average salary?
You're talking about like how much they
the maximum it could be, yeah.
Yeah. It'd be,
it wouldn't take that much, but that's what it is, right?
Yeah, no, it probably would not. So yeah, that would be plenty for him, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. So yeah, it's easy to keep him, and it's not like Ennis is going to have some crazy offer coming from somewhere else. So if you can use early bird to guarantee you have the highest offer, you know, that's not a terrible plan. And the Grizzlies want anything asset wise at this point. So I imagine as the second would be enough. The problem is that they traded their second in that Thaddeus Young trade, and the protections on it mean that they would have to do the opposite protections in another second round trade. And it would be horrible if it was protected in opposite ways the Nets one is. So I don't know if it has any value at all.
Yeah, no, that's difficult, obviously. And you would have expected this looks like a team that's going to be in the playoffs for a while. So maybe that has some more value just because the part of it that is protected, I think, is 31-44. And so it looks like they're going to be in the playoffs for a while. We thought that pick was going to go this year. It's probably not going to now. So maybe they could trade the unprotected part of that second rounder this year, and it could have some value. But, you know, if I'm Memphis, I probably would rather just hold on to Ennis and his early bird rights rather than get a second round pick. So there probably would have to be some additional value there, and calibrating that, because obviously a first round pick is probably too much for a guy like that. It becomes difficult. Maybe again, part of it could be, all right, you would get Ennis and, you know, we can take back, you know, maybe Ben McLemore as well, right? He's probably bad salary for next year, making about $5 million. Maybe that's what the price is. And then if the Pacers really have some unbelievable options for using their cap space that they need to get off of McLemore, they could stretch him or move him in the offseason. Maybe that would be the construct there to just take on a little bit of Memphis's bad money in addition to getting Ennis.
Yeah, that's not a bad plan. And I mean, McLemore would be another shooter on this Indiana team. So that's not a bad plan. But enough trade talk. We can all speculate and we're all going to be horribly wrong. But if you haven't listened, go listen to Nate, Danny, Dan Feldman, and Kevin Pelton's Mock Trade Deadline. Best podcasting episodes of every year by far. It's super fun. And it just came out this week, so it's very fresh and relevant information. But let's pivot to a little bit of look aheads. Where do you see this team finishing the rest of this year at in the standings in the East? You know, with the Pistons falling off, I think 6-8 is the most likely range, but I want to hear if you have a differing answer.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at 538's projections right now, they've got the Heat, Wizards, Bucks, Pacers all within a two-game range. Sixers actually projected to finish ahead of there, but I think, you know, they're always, if Embiid misses time, they can always drop off very easily. And, you know, the problem for the Pacers is, I think, you would expect both the Bucks and Wizards to play better from here on out. The Bucks have looked really good since firing Jason Kidd. They destroyed the Bulls last night. They destroyed the Nets over the weekend, and their defense is now more conservative. They're just letting their talent take hold. So I'd expect the Bucks to play better than the Pacers the rest of the way. The Wizards just generally have established a higher level than the Pacers as well. I think Miami could be due for some regression. They've had an extraordinary run lately in close games, but they're also about, a game and a half ahead of the Pacers right now. So if I had to guess, I would say the Pacers probably end up being the 7 or 8 seed. They're not going to feel a ton of pressure from behind with the Pistons and Hornets, I don't think. So I think they're very likely to make the playoffs, but I would look at 7 or 8 being more likely. And then obviously the Pacers are very vulnerable to injury as well. If Turner goes down there or any of their three bigs go down, they're really in trouble from a depth standpoint. And obviously if Oladipo goes down, well, you guys know how bad they were in those four games. They were, had like a -15 net rating in those games that Oladipo missed it with the sore knee. And that sore knee is something that seems like it could pop up again. It's not like he, had surgery and it's fixed, or it's just a muscle pull and it's fixed now. That's the type of thing that can linger. So I do have a little bit of concern there about whether he might have to miss more time at some point this year.
Well, and if you recall, he missed a game against the Celtics very early in the season with the same sore knee that caused him to miss that 4 in a row. So that's why, it seems like it already is a lingering thing that it concerns me. But they'll do whatever they can to keep him healthy, because they clearly go where he goes. What are you going to be watching on this team the rest of the year? Is it just that health stuff?
Yeah, that's one. And just whether Oladipo can maintain the shooting, that's a big one. And then Turner's defensive development, that's going to be so key for the future of this franchise, because he's got to turn into a defensive monster. He's got to turn into one of those guys who, all right, this guy's out there and we're a top 10 defense just because he's there. If this franchise is really talking about getting back to being a consistent 50 game winner, even with the great strides that they've made this year with Oladipo and Sabonis. And then the last thing will be, this is more of an offseason thing, but what happens with those non-guaranteed contracts they have? Bogdanovich and Collison in particular, those guys were real contributors. A couple of them, I don't remember the exact guarantee dates actually here. I'll look it up right now while I'm talking. But
June 29th for Collison, 2 days after the playoffs end for Joseph's player option, July 1st for Bogdanovich.
Joseph's player option is another one too. So they're going to have all this cap space, but they also could potentially be losing a lot of contributors. And so while there are far fewer teams with cap space this year, if they want to go the high risk, high reward route, maybe they don't even get as many guys as good as the guys that they could be leaving. And that could be a major problem for them. And also the fact that there's these new rules now where when you trade those guys, they only count for the amount that they have in guaranteed salary outgoing. They can't really bring back as much salary for them as well if they wanted to trade them. So that's also really interesting as well. They're going to be, just from a CBA nerd standpoint, one of the big aspects or one of the big test cases for the application of that new rule.
They seem like that seems like a draft night trade kind of thing too, because they lose $9 million of trade value in, in cash going out in 10 days. So it changes everything.
Yeah.
But that'll be fascinating to see. All right, man, where can people follow you on Twitter and all your stuff if they don't already for some reason?
Yeah, Nate Duncan NBA is the Twitter, also on Periscope as well. We do live calls of games as an alternate to the play-by-play. You sync up with our audio and the game to do that. And the Dunked On podcast is 5 days a week, Sunday nights through Thursday nights, very late at night here on the Pacific Coast.
Yeah, one of the best general NBA podcasts out there. Nate and Danny do a great job. And don't forget about the Patreon.
Yeah, that's true. If you want to support our work, patreon.com/DuncanLarue. But let's see if they listen to it first, and then if they want to support it. We're trying to reel them in before we ask for their money.
Well, I like the cap sheets on there. I keep my own, so yours are way cooler, more organized. But yeah, thanks for coming on, man. I appreciate it.
All right, my pleasure, Tony.
We'll be back tomorrow to preview the Grizzlies game. Adam will be here. We'll talk about all the games this week, and we'll do some trade deadline stuff too. It'll be worse than this one, but it'll still be good. Everybody have a great rest of your Tuesday, and we'll see you tomorrow.